The Taj Mahal took 21 years to build. I had no idea it was this old. So it was constructed from 1632 to 1653. So this building is 400 years old. And it was a gift from an emperor to his wife. And it became her tomb, and then later on it became his tomb as well. And from what I understand, it is unbelievably ornate. It has a base, it has a dome, it has a minaret, it has plant motifs on the wall, it has a reflective tile, and it also has a marble jolly lattice. When you look into it, when you go to the inside, it has interiors that have flowers that are carved in marble, it has incised paintings, it has finial floor tiles. It is considered to be essentially, as far as a structure is concerned, it's a work of art. So this building has been valued at over $800 million. And it's really not that big. We look at the pictures and you think, well, that's a really impressive building. But if you see someone standing at it and to kind of put it into scale, it's not an extremely large building, but valued at $800 million. It's so valuable that it's on the list. It makes multiple lists of the top most expensive gifts ever given to anyone else. Gift giving's kind of tough. And it doesn't matter if you think about Christmas time or birthdays or anniversary. Gift giving's tough. And I think kind of finding the perfect gift, I talk about it from the standpoint of a man, but I know that with ladies, it's just the same way. I think about, it takes a lot of creativity, obviously it takes a lot of effort, takes a lot of diligence, takes a lot of forethought. Some years, I'm better at that than others. I'm actually very, very thankful to have children because they get to chime in and that makes it much, much easier. But gifts that you can give. What are gifts that you can give? I think we need lessons like this because we need lessons on how to be better children of God toward one another. Not that by saying that, it means that I think that there are deficiencies in the crowd. I don't think that at all. But it's always good. Is it not always upbuilding in some way to bring up to all of us? You know, and as I sit here and I write this over the last, so I sit here and think, well, that is something that I need to do better at. I'm glad that I do that. And these are reminders for me to help me to be able to give the best possible gifts that I can. The great part about this is that they're all free. They're all free because they're based in Scripture. They're based on our participation in the gospel of Jesus Christ. So these are the best gifts that we can give to one another. We're going to begin with the gift of praise. I ask you to turn to Hebrews chapter 13 in the 15th verse, and we will get to that in just a second. What does praise do? Praise builds up. It lifts people's spirits. It brings people smiles. It recognizes accomplishments. It restores confidence. It gives hope. The writer George W. Adams said, "Encouragement is oxygen to the soul." I really, really liked that. Praise is encouragement or oxygen to the soul. So Hebrews chapter 13, verse 15, of course we give praise to God. And the foundational point for me to be able to give praise to others is understanding that I'm going to give praise to God. So the people who can give praise to God end up being pretty good people who can give praise to others. So Hebrews chapter 13, verse 15 says, "Therefore, by him, let us continually offer the sacrifice of praise to God. That is the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name." So as we're giving and as we're offering praise to God, then we give praise to each other. Of course. You know, we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that there's going to be times where we have to deal with people, and we have to deal with them, unfortunately, in more of a negative way. 2 Timothy chapter 4, for example, turn with me there. 2 Timothy chapter 4, Paul used that passage to essentially define gospel preaching. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1, I'm going to charge you before the Lord Jesus Christ because he is the judge. Then in verse 2, here's really the definitive nature of preaching. You preach the word, you be ready in season and out of season. You convince, you rebuke, you exhort. So convincing and exhorting, of course, more positive in nature, but there's also that rebuke. In verse 3, for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers. So what do you have to do? Well, sometimes you've got to be quite negative, you know, more negative than you would want to be. But yet you do that because it builds up. You think about Galatians chapter 2. Even Peter, who was able to make that great confession when Jesus spoke about building his kingdom, in Galatians chapter 2 and verses 11 through 14, still made wrong decisions. And Paul was there to rebuke him. So guys, we understand and we know that that is just going to happen at times. But as we take the opportunity, we need to be people who can indeed be encouraging and exhorting to one another. Let's look in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 because it is very, very simple. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, and let's look in the 11th verse. So 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and the 11th verse. So therefore comfort each other and edify one another just as you also are doing. And that can be a form of notes. You know, I'm kind of reached that point now where you go by, and it's not unheard of, but it is, you don't see it a lot anymore. You know, I can go all the way back to the time where you'd get a note in the mail, and I mean, it was an actual note in the mail, a piece of 8.5 by 11, trifolded, pull it out, and it's an encouraging note that you've received. Maybe a card. You know, we've moved on digitally. I kind of went through the era of email. Email's still a great way to communicate. But now it's more kind of like text messages. People still love to send cards. People even still send notes. I mean, lots and lots of them. Well, brethren, that ability to build up, to praise, to encourage, just like Mr. Adams said, it's like oxygen to the soul. And why do we do that? Well, let's look in Ephesians chapter 2. In Ephesians chapter 2, it bears repeating, and to me it bears repeating consistently. Ephesians chapter 2, when we look down in the end of the chapter, let's start in the 20th verse. Ephesians chapter 2, and looking in the 20th verse, kind of setting the stage for the importance of the church. He says, then, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone. What we are a part of is something very important, and it's very significant. But there's more to it. There's more dimensions to it. I'm thinking about us looking at a lesson next Sunday evening that looks at these dimensions of what the church is. So look in verse 21. In whom the whole building, being fitted together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. Now, that absolutely is being done because we are coming to Jesus Christ, we are being added to His church, but then as being parts of this glorious institution, what are we doing to one another? We're praising and we're encouraging. Yes, rebuking when necessary. But praising and encouraging builds a group up. It edifies them. Acts chapter 9, verse 31, it helps them to walk in the fear of the Lord. And then what's the result? The result is the body grows. I know that everyone's got different experiences. And the fact that your experience may differ with mine, that is completely okay with me. But I've found over and over again, when people come to a congregation and they make the decision to stay at a congregation, it's easy for us to look at and pick out all the deficiencies. The brain is wired to see something different. When I look into a landscape, I don't see what is stationary. I see what's moving. I see what's different. So we want to look at something and we want to see the negative. We want to see, well, the carpet's kind of worn, or maybe the pews aren't, the padding on the pews is not what it once was. The outside, but maybe it doesn't look quite as good as it was. And we think we're sunk. We're sunk. The vast majority of the time, I've found that when people come, they come to be a part of a group where they recognize, look, this place can build me up. This place can encourage me, and this place can make sure that they offer that praise. It's what people are attracted to. So one of the best gifts that you can give free is the gift of praise. Secondly, let's talk about the gift of understanding. The gift of understanding. So Stephen Covey wrote one of the most successful, and I think I could safely say it is a business-oriented book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And he said, seek first to understand, then to be understood. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. And how often do people want to be understood? I doubt there is a parent who hasn't heard, at least in some way, this, the sentiment, maybe even the exact expression. And if there's a lot of parents in the audience who don't have children yet who are this old, you probably will hear it, where they say, Mom, Dad, you just don't understand. And it could be one of 12 different things, but you just don't understand. Wives who would say, my husband just doesn't understand me. Or a husband who would say, a wife just doesn't understand me. I mean, it just simply happens all of the time. Deep down, we want understanding. In fact, in 1 Peter chapter 3 in the 7th verse, and while you're turning there to 1 Peter chapter 3 verse 7, let me just kind of add, this lesson is really not a lesson about marriage. These are not gifts that I intended for husbands to give to wives or vice versa. It actually, interestingly, works out that way, but these are gifts that we are giving to one another. And this one is illustrated quite nicely in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7, because there it says that he wants husbands to live with your wives in an understanding way. In an understanding way. And when I started looking at the different versions, the different English versions pretty consistently put it as an understanding way. Now, the NIV put it as a considerate way. A considerate way. Now, some versions modify that just a little bit. Live with your mate with consideration. So, the idea of being considerate or the idea of being understanding means insight and tact. A conscious sensibility to God's will. A conscious sensibility to God's will. So, husbands, you live with your wives in a way that shows your conscious understanding of God's will. You treat her the way that a Christian ought to be treated. Now, this is going to apply to everyone because the same point can be made about wives treating their husbands in a way that's conscious of God's will. And of all of us treating each other in a way that is conscious of God's will. What is that way? Well, it's a way of understanding. And I like the idea, at least the lead-in in Luke chapter 24, and if you'll look in verse 45. In Luke chapter 24, verse 45, this is Jesus, and he's on the road to Emmaus, and he appears to two disciples on this road, and he's talking to them. And he's explaining to them who he is. And it says in Luke chapter 24 and verse 45 that he opened their understanding. When he opened their understanding, they of course got it. They understood that he was Jesus. in thinking about that just a little bit differently, I need to open the words of Jesus. Because what the words of Jesus are going to help me to do is to have the kind of understanding that I can use to treat other people, a gift that I can give them. Just as an example, of course, you know that when we talk about something like this, there is no finer place to go than the book of Proverbs. So let's go, just three that we'll survey real quick. So let's go to Proverbs chapter 14, first of all. Proverbs chapter 14. And in Proverbs chapter 14, we are going to look at the 22nd verse. So Proverbs chapter 14 and looking in verse 22. There, Proverbs chapter 14 and reading the 22nd verse. Proverbs chapter 14. Let me get to that. Yeah, Proverbs chapter 14 and we look in verse 22 says, "Do they not go astray who devise evil, but mercy and truth belong to those who devise good," people who have that understanding. When you look a little bit further, go down, just glance at verse 29. There's a handful of these. "He who is slow to wrath has great understanding. He who is impulsive exalts" what? Exalts folly. Now the Proverbs continue on when we go to chapter 17. Go to chapter 17, look in verse 27. So chapter 17, now look down in verse 27. Something very similar is said, again, keeping us in true understanding, and by keeping us in understanding, showing us the way that we ought to live. "He also who has knowledge spares his words, and a man of understanding is of" what kind of spirit? Calm spirit. Calm spirit. You give the gift of understanding, you're going to make every single relationship that you have better. Let me just give you one more. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 18. You're pretty close there. Just go down to Proverbs chapter 18, look in verse 2. "A fool has no delight in understanding, but in expressing his own heart." A person of understanding is conscious of God's will. A fool is someone who's going to let you know their opinion, let you know how they feel, no matter what. A couple of quotes that I've always thought that these were good. Dale Carnegie observed, he says, "Anyone can criticize, complain, and condemn. And most fools do." He said, "But it takes character and self-control to be understanding and forgiving." I don't think there's a better place to see that illustrated than, honestly, on social media. Another place for you, another person to consider, George Bernard Shaw added, "The worst sin towards our fellow creatures is not to hate them, but to be indifferent, because that is the essence of inhumanity." What gifts do we need to give to one another? We need to give people the gift of praise. But we also need to give people the gift of understanding. Because that gift of understanding helps us to know what they're doing, helps us to know what they're going through, and then we make positive changes in their lives. We build their lives up. It's an incredible gift to give. But let's go on. Let's talk about the gift of gratitude. The gift of gratitude. The ancient Roman philosopher Cicero said, "Gratitude is not only the greatest of virtues, it is the parent of all virtues." So he said that gratitude is not just the greatest of virtues, it is the parent of all virtues. So, Psalm chapter 118, we could go, I mean, just all over the place with this. I'm just going to give you a couple of examples. Psalm chapter 118. So looking in Psalm chapter 118, if you'll turn down with me to the 24th verse. This one, a fairly well-known one. Psalm 118 and looking down in verse 24, what does it tell us? "This is the day that the Lord has made." What do we do? Let's rejoice and let's be glad in it. Or let's go down to Psalm chapter 136. Go with me down to Psalm chapter 136. And in Psalm chapter 136, this is what's referred to as an antiphonal psalm. I have to kind of wait and pause to make sure I get that word out. An antiphonal psalm, that is, it's got a statement that is made, and then as soon as the statement is made, there is kind of the secondary statement that's made. Especially if you're able to see Psalm 136 kind of in its entirety, like on a Bible page, you can see this immediately. But Psalm chapter 136, and starting in verse 1, "Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for He is good." And then here comes the antiphonal part, "For His mercy endures forever." And that goes all the way through every single verse. But it's interesting where the psalm begins, because there's all different kinds of ideas that are mentioned in the psalm. But where does it start? Give thanks to the Lord. Well, what does the New Testament do? Pretty much the same. In fact, Paul encourages us to be thankful, to offer up thanks. The book of Colossians, the book of Thessalonians. In fact, pretty much just about everywhere you turn in the New Testament, we've got one of two ideas. The first one's in Hebrews chapter 12. The first one's in Hebrews chapter 12. We cannot neglect the idea in Hebrews chapter 12, even though it's not the major idea that I want to focus on, but we offer thanks to God. I know that sounds odd when I say that that's not the major point I want to focus on, but just bear with me. Hebrews chapter 12, and look in verse 28. Hebrews 12, verse 28. "Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace." That's the New King James Version, but a lot of the newer versions or different versions will talk about "let us be thankful, let us have gratitude, by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear." So yes, we are thankful to God when the young men come and do what they've been working on next week. They'll offer up their prayers to God, and they are very, very good about thanking God for everything, and we should be. But the main point of this specific lesson tonight is making sure that we're thankful for each other. Let's go to 2 Thessalonians. Paul was very, very good at this. In just about every single letter that he wrote, he made absolutely sure that he thanked the brethren. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 3, it's just slightly different. "We are bound to thank God always for you, brethren, as it is fitting, because your faith grows exceedingly, and the love of every one of you all abounds toward each other." I'll tell you, it is a pretty remarkable thought when we ask the question, do we offer thanks to God for our brethren? I sure hope we do, and I believe that we do. And we may offer thanks to God for our brethren just collectively. You know, we're thankful for everyone that is a member here at the Luke 287 Church of Christ. We may offer thanks to God personally for some specific brother or sister who's a close friend to us, or maybe has helped us in a very particular way in a difficult time in our life. But I would ask you, I would even kind of challenge you, do we thank God for each other? Paul was willing to thank God for the Thessalonians, and I'll tell you, brethren, the more that we thank God for people in our family, in our church, in our school, in our neighborhoods, then the more that we're going to always live a life of gratitude. Let's go to Matthew chapter 6, verse 21. And I know it's an interesting verse. It's not the place where normally you would go to look at something like this. But just go with me to Matthew chapter 6, verse 21. Matthew chapter 6, verse 21, I've kind of been down on social media, but it's not all bad. It's not all bad. In fact, there are some fantastic reminders. And one of them was in the form of Matthew 6, 21 for me and my friends just several days ago. And Matthew 6, verse 21, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." The distinctive part, of course, in Matthew chapter 6 is that it's talking about riches, so don't put your heart into your riches, because those aren't going to last. I just bring it up to to think about another pair. So in the context itself, you've got the fact of all of the material parts of life versus the spiritual parts of life. So don't put your, don't put all of your trust, don't put all of your love into the material part of the life. So let's think about a different pair of things. Let's think about gratitude versus complaining. Because everyone has something in their life to complain about. And I'm actually not knocking necessarily complaining, because a lot of the things that people would complain about are very, very serious. When I bring this up, I'm not saying that what you might complain about is in any way something like negligible. Believe me, I understand. If you have something to complain about, it may very well be worth complaining about. I get it. But where your heart is, there your treasure will be also. And I have to learn the lesson, you know, to be more grateful for what I have. You know, the longer that goes on in my life, and all of you guys who are older could say, they're probably going to say in the next few seconds, I could have told you that. I know. But the further I get in my life, physically, I'm understanding the more I have to leave behind. And so it's really easy to want to complain about that. But I need to be grateful always for what I do have. Because why? Because Matthew 6, verse 21. Because where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So make yourself a treasure of gratitude. And then share that treasure with someone else so that their heart is filled with the gratitude of what God has done for them and what their brethren can accomplish for them as well. I tell you, it's an incredible, incredible gift. Let's bring up the gift of concession. The gift of concession. So briefly stated, you don't have to be right all of the time. You don't have to win all of the time. You don't have to have your way all of the time. We learn that we give to one another. And that idea is the idea of concession. I do need to follow it up by quickly adding that we don't compromise truth. We're not talking about in any way conceding truth. I know that. Truth sets me free. I know that I have to stand for truth. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 11, I need to make sure that I reprove. I need to make sure that I rebuke, that I stay away from the unfruitful works of darkness. I'm not talking in any way conceding anything to truth. But I am talking about a specific idea about our concession to one another. Let's go to Romans chapter 14, because in Romans chapter 14 and 15, and also in 1 Corinthians chapters 8, 9, and 10, there is a concept, in fact, a pretty predominant concept. If you think about Romans 14 and 15, and then you've got 1 Corinthians chapters 8, 9, and 10, you have what you could, I mean, rightfully say, a significant amount of the New Testament that addresses this particular issue of our opinions. In Romans chapter 14, when you look in verse 1, here's how Paul puts it. In Romans chapter 14, in verse 1, it says, "Receive one who is weak in the flesh, but not to dispute over doubtful things." Now, some versions just kind of cut right to it and talk about opinions. Now, Romans chapter 14 and 1 Corinthians chapter 8 are talking about matters that God hasn't legislated on it. So we all have differing opinions that really don't have any solid connection to truth. It's just the way that we feel. And you might feel one way about a specific matter, and someone else may feel a different way. Well, the point of Romans chapter 14 and 15 and the point of 1 Corinthians chapters 8, 9, and 10 is that it is acceptable in matters where God has not revealed a will for people to feel differently. Now, in these two texts that we're talking about, Paul's talking about them under the guise, I believe, in Romans chapter 14, of people wanting to kind of go back and observe some of those parts of their Jewish heritage. It was okay for them to do it. In 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10, Paul kind of turns more to the idea of offering meat to idols. Paul knew that there wasn't anything to an idol, so he could eat the meat. But there would be some people who would have a very strong opinion not to eat the meat that was offered to the idol. So you have these differing opinions. Well, in Romans chapter 14, let's go in verse 2 now, because we're going to be able to see just a really quickly some principles. So in verse 2, "For one believes that he may eat all things, but he who is weak only will eat only vegetables. Let not him who eats despise him who does not eat." So first of all, we don't despise. "And then let him who does not eat judge him who eats, for God has received him." So there's the portion of those who despise, and then there's the portion of those who judge. Paul said in these matters that don't include divine revealed truth, you don't despise and you don't judge. We go a little bit further down into Romans. Let's look in verse 10. Just kind of go down to verse 10, because in Romans chapter 14 and beginning in verse 10, we've got kind of the principle that's continued to be developed. "But why do you judge your brother? Or why do you show contempt for your brother?" Remember, that's the two things you shouldn't do. "For we shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ." In verse 11, "For it is written, as I live, says the Lord, every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue shall confess to God." Don't judge one another, because God's going to do that. Now down in verse 20. Look down in verse 20, Romans chapter 14, and when we start reading in verse 20, again, more principles for us to live by. "Do not destroy the work of God for the sake of food." Don't destroy the work of God for the sake of holding to these opinions. I'll tell you, opinionated churches are doomed. Opinionated churches are doomed. I've seen a lot of them. A lot of them. Very, very rarely do churches with people who have lots of opinions ever flourish. And one of the reasons why is they tend to want to beat each other up over the opinions. Don't destroy the work of God for these opinions. It says, "But it is evil for the man who eats with offense." In verse 21, "It is good neither to eat meat, nor to drink wine, nor to do anything by which your brother stumbles, or is offended, or is made weak. Do you have faith? Have it to yourself before God." He's not talking about revealed divine will. He's not talking about the faith that's developed. Do you have an opinion? Okay. Have it to yourself with God. "Happy is he who does not condemn himself in what he approves." So if you've got a conscientious issue with something, don't violate your conscience. Verse 23, "But he who doubts is condemned if he eats, because he does not eat from faith, for whatever is not from faith is sin." And the faith that he's speaking about is the faith that someone has based on their own opinion, not on revealed divine will. Now, Paul said you don't have to cast aside that opinion, just don't despise and don't judge with it. Now, we could go on further. For example, let's look in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. Just pick up a handful of verses from 1 Corinthians chapter 8. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, let's start with verse 9. So here's what Paul says, 1 Corinthians 8, verse 9. "But beware lest somehow this liberty of yours..." So this opinion, you understand, you can eat meat that is sacrificed to idols. This is the liberty that he's talking about in this case. So, "But beware lest somehow this liberty of yours becomes a stumbling block to those who are weak. Don't use it again to destroy someone." Verse 12. Let's look in verse 12. "But when you thus sin against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ." Verse 13. "Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never again eat meat lest I make my brother stumble." So Paul could either eat or he could not eat. The point is not revealed divine will. No one's opinion is right all of the time. You may think it is the best, most logically held, clearly thought out opinion that could possibly ever be believed. No one's opinion is right all of the time. Divine revealed will is always right. And it takes a lot of spiritual discernment to be able to tell the difference between divine revealed will and someone's opinion that they have. Not that we don't look down on opinions. We live by a lot of, probably more than you recognize. We just understand that we concede to one another in those matters. That's a gift, because if you don't give that gift, I'm telling you, churches are doomed. Let me give you one more. Let's consider one more. And that is the gift of attention. So I told you it's not really a marriage lesson. I never intended it that way. But all of these gifts, if you turn it into something that's between a man and a woman, it works out pretty well. An old proverb says, attention is like a daily bouquet of love. Attention is like a daily bouquet of love. So giving someone time, giving someone respect, and giving someone attention is one of the best, most finest gifts that you can give. And yes, if you apply it in your marriage, you are wise. However, if you as a parent apply it to your children, you're also pretty wise. And if you will apply it to your brethren, yet again, you are someone incredibly wise. Let's look in 2 Timothy chapter 3. Let's look in 2 Timothy chapter 3, because this is something that's going to kind of take a bit of a negative turn, but there's a point to it. 2 Timothy chapter 3, and we're going to look starting in verse 1. But know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. Very ominous. For men will be lovers of themselves. Lovers of themselves. I think I could very accurately say that they would be what? They would be inconsiderate. And someone who is inconsiderate is going to be inattentive to the wants and the wishes and the needs of someone else. So Paul's already warning us, look, perilous times are going to come. This is what's going to take place. You need to stay away from that. What's one of the ways that I can stay away from that? I can pay attention to someone else. James chapter 3, let's look there. James chapter 3, notice this in James chapter 3. Maybe again you haven't thought about applying it this way, but I just want you to consider it. In James chapter 3, and as we look in James chapter 3, and we look in the 15th verse. That'll give us some context. Begin in verse 14, for example. If you have bitter envying and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and sin against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above, but it is earthly, sensual, demonic. Then keep going in 16 now. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. So if our lives are not lives that can be defined by giving attention to someone else, effectively, James is saying that confusion and every evil thing are there. Confusion and every evil thing are there. So Philippians chapter 2, verse 4, one particular version says that we need to pay attention to the interest of others. Pay attention to the interest of others. And this one, I think, is actually a nice, appropriate way to sum up all of them. So you think about the gifts of praising and of understanding and of conceding and all of this. How is it best possibly summed up? By giving attention. Ephesians chapter 5 and verses 15 and 16, just as a way to kind of consider this, and again, consider it in a way that wraps everything up. Ephesians chapter 5, and let's look in verses 15 and 16. See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise. Look at this, redeeming the time, because the days are evil. So my redemption of time then can include my attention that I give to others. Again, maybe my spouse, maybe my children, it may be my brethren. But it needs to be something. Writer Jim Rohr said, wherever you are, be there. Wherever you are, be there. I've heard people kind of talk about it in different ways. Be in the moment, what have you. Wherever you are, be there. We have probably one of the greatest temptations for us to not be attentive in the last 15 years than anyone could have possibly. People 100 years ago could have probably never, ever thought that this invention could become so prolific and such a takeaway of the attention that we need to give to one another. And that is the lowly smartphone. Wherever you are, be there. Is that a lesson that I need to learn? Yeah, it's a lesson that I need to learn, because I need to give attention. Sometimes that attention can be more to my wife. Sometimes it can be more to my children. Maybe even sometimes you've thought it could be to you. Wherever you are, be there. It's a tremendous gift. So when I think about the idea of giving gifts, I think about the idea of giving gifts. I said at the beginning that all of these gifts were free, and they are. I mean, they're easy to give. I stand by that. But I also know, I mean, everyone realizes that sometimes these aren't so easy to give when people can be, and I'm just in kind of thinking about what can people do. Sometimes people can be unkind. Sometimes people can be indifferent. And sometimes people can refuse to reciprocate. That makes gift giving pretty tough. But these kinds of gifts are worth, the reward that you're going to get is worth the price of giving them. So I want you to think about this. It is sad. It's sad to spend so much effort, so much money, so much time thinking about and buying all of these gifts that we have for each other that are physical gifts, and they're really, really nice, but they're not actually what we need. What we really need are these gifts that we've talked about tonight. The gifts that lay right along with principles in the gospel of how Christians orient themselves to Jesus Christ and then are able to treat each other. And not just treat each other, but to treat everyone. So give gifts that count, even though it can be difficult, because the circumstances can be difficult. But if you do it, if you can persevere, it's going to immeasurably add to the kind of life that you can have. The greatest gift of all is the gift of Christ Jesus. The greatest gift of all is the gift of salvation. That is the gift that we consistently talk about every single time that we come together. That is a free gift, a gift that you can have by God's grace, and a gift that you can acknowledge and tell us about that you want this very night. So we invite people. We encourage you to come up and take hold of that gift. Tell us, this is what you want. Maybe someone's kind of gotten away from Christ. We want you to come back and say, you know, I need to have that free gift again. I need to be restored back to faithful service. That's our invitation for you, and it is certainly our desire for you to act on it, for you to acknowledge it, and for you to tell us this is what you want to do. Let's do so, please. Let's stand and sing.